Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we'll do a classic album dissection of the 1982 X album, Under the Big Black Sun. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, X vocalist, bassist, solo artist, and actor, John Doe.
We want to welcome John Doe to the show. Great new solo album out, 40-plus years of history. It's like almost daunting, John, to chat with you because we don't even know where to start. But welcome to Sound Opinions.
Well, thank you. And you may start wherever you choose. You've already started at the most important place.
Yeah. Why don't we chat about that? And then on Sound Opinions, we do these classic album dissections when there's an album that changed Greg's life, my life, and there's a significant date. But I want to talk about the newest stuff first. That's a great idea.
I can roll this into where I am and what inspired this record.
Yeah, you're in Chicago, right?
No, I am in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. I heard you were spending some time here.
No, I'm in Tulsa, and it's because they're opening the Bob Dylan Center. I got invited here because I wrote 1,000 words or so on a record, which also inspired or was part of the inspiration for this new record, a Bob Dylan record.
Which one?
John Wesley Harding.
Ah, okay. The new solo album is Fables in a Foreign Land. It's raw, it's rootsy, it is just a great record, John. Congratulations.
Is it a raw, rootsy record?
Yes! It is. It sounds like a Fat Possum record, you know? They did the last X record, and you're putting this solo album out with them. Some impressive guests, Louis Perez from Los Lobos. So what's the Dylan connection?
I don't know exactly how, probably because, you know, I got to be part of the Music Cares show that Bob picked all the people that were going to be singing and participating in that, and I was lucky enough to get chosen. And we've met each other over the years a couple times, and it's always been pretty positive. I got to open for him at the Hollywood Palladium once, and so there's a history. And I, of course, like a lot of songwriters, I was totally influenced by Bob Dylan. I mean, he's one of those guys, right? So they called me, I think it was 4 years ago, to come up here and look at some of the archive before they had solidified how and what the Dylan Center was going to be. And they were asking journalists and some musicians to come up and pick a record of Bob's that was influential. John Wesley Harding was the one that I felt like was mine. And so I looked at a bunch of notebooks that Bob Dylan, you know, wrote while that record was being made. I listened to all these different takes they have available of that session.
Oh, wow.
And some of them are basically the same. And then you hear the one that was on the record and you go, oh, yeah, there's the one. But there's not much changes. But the song that inspired me most was As I Went Out One Morning, which started as a very slow 3-4 version. They do two takes of the slow 3-4 time, and then the third take is completely different. It was a great choice.
It was obvious, huh?
As I went out one morning to breathe the air around Tom Paine's. I spied the fairest damsel.
Good choice, because the other one was kind of lugubrious. Yeah, it didn't really have the pep. And there were only four takes. I always loved the simplicity of that record, and I've kind of grown tired of overdubs, and I've begun to appreciate space a lot more than filler or licks.
Well, when you talk about that record, that Dylan record being an influence, you know, you look at even the cover image, that sort of sepia-toned photo on the cover, and the way the music is, it was just coming off his Electric period, you know, and now he'd made this kind of more insular kind of acoustic-based record, it seemed like. You talk about your new record being set in the end of the 1890s. It almost seems like the idea of an 1890s setting would fit John Wesley Harding, too, in some ways.
That's true. It was a challenge for me. I mean, a couple of songs came along of this new record, and then I thought, oh, well, this is similar to, you know, a couple of other songs I'd written earlier, and do I really want to have any modern references? Maybe no. And maybe I can stay disciplined and keep it on track to tell a story. There's a beginning and an end. The middle is, like, open to interpretation. It's more like what this narrator either experienced or stories that he or she was told. I think my desire is similar to maybe what any songwriter, or certainly Bob's, was on John Wesley Harding, is to allow the listener to step into a world that you create, walk around, see what it's like, attach yourself to some of the experiences or experience those things secondhand, and just have that feeling of what it's like. And so that's why there's a lot of stories, a lot of heavy imagery and sort of cinematic stuff, because that always appeals to me.
I noticed that you worked with Terry Allen on this record. Underappreciated, I think, singer-songwriter from Texas. Lubbock guy, I think, was the origin. He wrote a great song about Lubbock back in the day.
Yes.
Terry's a character. How did you meet him? How did you work together on this record?
He was on one of those train trips that Dave Alvin used to host. Get on in Los Angeles and get off wherever you felt like it. And so Terry and I just hit it off. And he invited me to do this songwriter conference that he does in Marfa around July. And that's his and Joe Harvey's anniversary. And we wrote a few songs with several other people, with Bucca, his and Bale, his sons, and Joe Harvey's sons, and Charlie Sexton. We wrote a couple of really good songs. So I thought maybe he's got some other lyrics or some chords that he hasn't finished, or, you know, because Terry's a great songwriter, storyteller as well. I sent him that song Never Coming Back, just as a idea of here's where this record is going.
They're never coming back. You killed my ma and pa, burned down their shack. I'm going far away.
Thinking that he would listen to that as inspiration, but he ended up sending me a bunch of additional lyrics and, like, here's a bridge and here's a, you know, and I'm thinking, like, well, actually, that song is done, but maybe it's not. So, yeah, I added some of his words in the chorus, that never coming back. That, and, you know, just sort of opening up with Luis Perez and on that song, El Romanzo, and also Shirley Manson and Exene on Destroying Angels. So, good process.
Never Coming Back's a killer opening track and leads us on this journey. There's an intimacy on this record. And I was wondering, I mean, it had to be recorded during lockdown, right, John? I mean, because it sounds like, you know, a back porch hootenanny, you know, around the campfire. You know, Shirley Manson and Louis coming in and Exene. How did you manage to pull that off when we were all stuck in our holes for 2 years?
Well, you know, unfortunately, Shirley and Exene and Louis didn't sing or play on the record, because I would have loved to have them, but we couldn't. But they're contributing to the songwriting. And we pulled it off by me calling up Kevin Smith, who normally tours with Willie Nelson, saying, can we get together on your patio? And he said, yes, please. Then called Conrad Chacroon, who had been touring with Patty Griffin, and we had played a couple of gigs together, the three of us, and it just seemed like it was going to serve these songs, and wrote songs from, say, April 2020 into when we recorded, which was, the middle of 2021.
So there really was a patio involved. I nailed that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's back porch, patio, whatever you want to call it. And because I just wanted to serve the songs, we didn't have to have amplifiers and we didn't have to have a PA system. And in the recording studio, we didn't use headphones. We just sang and played into the air because Kevin's playing upright. Conrad can muffle his drums enough to, you know, hear the vocals over top, and we just had to listen to each other.
You've been pretty busy. I mean, you just did an X record, first one in a long time, and then right away you come up with this pretty thought-out concept record. Was this something that was percolating for a long time, or how did you get to the point where you could put out such a thought-through solo record on top of a record with your old band?
Not really all that thought out. It does have a beginning and it does have an end, but like I said, the middle is a little bit up to interpretation. I had been thinking about doing John Doe Folk Trio. I did that maybe 7 or 8 years ago when we still lived in California. And it was with some friends that I had made other records with, and it always turned into more of a folk rock trio and actually leaning more heavily on the rock. So I didn't get that shuffly thing that could be played in the back of a bar or around a campfire or something like that. And I give Kevin and Conrad all the credit in the world for coming up with that sound. I mean, yeah, I had these songs. I just kept shifting them so that they didn't have modern references. You know, there's a story arc maybe to each song, but not a story arc to the whole record. It is a concept record without pretension. It just is set in a certain time. I pulled a number of pieces of writing that I had done over the years, touring in vans and seeing the countryside and feeling isolated and feeling alone and lonely. That luckily related to what we had all just gone through. So I'm hoping that, you know, people can listen to this and think about 2021, that sort of thing.
I kept flashing Greg, and Greg and I are huge fans, were huge fans of Deadwood. There had been a house band in Al Swearingen's bar. I think you're short-selling the middle of the record, because that kind of storytelling, something like the cowboy in the hot air balloon. I mean, I can just picture, you know, some character fronting this trio, you know, while Al is doing his dirty deeds in the bar, telling us this story.
Oh, stop. You're making me blush. You're talking my language. What can I say? In my dreams, right, my friend. And in my dreams, you know, or maybe some Sam Peckinpah movie.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, with a surplus of blood capsules. In your 40 or 50 odd movie roles, have you ever had to, like, get shot?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have.
I was racking my brain trying to remember.
Well, there was one at the very beginning, which T-Bone Burnett and this guy Hudson Marquez, who's an artist, sort of directed and produced. It was a short movie called The Spanish Kitchen. It's a legend in L.A., this kitchen on Beverly, which was right next to where the original Slash Records headquarters was. And it closed mysteriously. And you could look through the Venetian blinds in the front window, and because they had sort of fallen apart because it closed sometime in the 50s, I think, or maybe 60s. The Venetian blinds had started to fall apart, and you could see all the silverware still on the table and the napkins. And it was just like, we're done. And then they didn't even clear it out. They didn't prepare me, and they shot it off. And I think I said, oh, I'm shot. Which you're not supposed to do. But I guess the best stunt I had was in Roadhouse. I got hit with a knife, a big Bowie knife that came into my chest. And they did. They put a big plastic plate and then a piece of wood under my shirt and then ran a thread through the shirt, like out 30 feet away. And then they had a steel barrel on the top of this knife and they just zinged it along the this wire. And it went like, bam, into my chest. It's like, that was like someone punching you in the chest. It was no fun.
Man, that's suffering for the art.
Terrifying. I know.
Suffering. Roadhouse. Now there was a movie.
That was so much fun doing Roadhouse. It was totally seeing the elephant. It was like a Joel Silver production with Ben Gazzara and, you know, Patrick
Chewing
Swayze.
The scenery, Ben Gazzara.
Oh, yeah. My God. Oh, my God. But having the best time. Having the best time being a great villain and just so much money, so much money. Oh my God. When they ran over those cars and just drove through the car showroom, they had built that whole thing.
Just to destroy it.
Yeah.
Did your experiences with Hollywood, John, ever make you wonder, am I in the wrong business? not film, but this punk rock thing, I'm hauling my own amplifier for 40 years.
Are you kidding?
When we return, we dive into the X album Under the Big Black Sun with John Doe for its 40th anniversary. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. This week, we're talking all things X, the LA punk band that melded together different musical styles and went on to influence many other bands. Before we jump into our classic album dissection of Under the Big Black Sun with vocalist bassist John Doe, we want to give a little context. Greg, it always struck me that Los Angeles was a little bit late to the party. If we look at 76, 77 as the high water mark of the New York and London punk scenes, LA heats up a little later, right?
Well, you know, everybody, when the Ramones album hit in 76, that was a big moment for a lot of bands. I mean, we can do this. Listen to what these guys are doing. Maybe we can do something like this as well. I think these bands were already kind of in the air a little bit, but the idea that you could actually get up on a stage and get a gig at a club, heavily motivated by that Ramones debut album. Not only did it influence the English punk scene, but the LA punk scene similarly. You're right. You know, 1976 was kind of the formative moment. 77, 78, we started to see records from bands like the Germs. Mm. You can't have a better punk rock name than Darby Crash. You had the Screamers, who, to my mind, you know, one of the first punk bands, and, you know, already kind of out of the mode of, like, it's got to be guitar, bass, and drums. I mean, they were doing these electronic elements in their music, you know? You had the Weirdos, you know, they had the cropped hair, the tongue-in-cheek attitude. You know, the idea that there was an element of there is weirdness. We were the weird kids in school. Now we're the weird kids on stage, inspiring other weird kids to do the same thing that we're doing. The Dills, you know, the precursors to Rank and File. They had songs like Class War and I Hate the Rich, you know, anthems. The Dickies kind of doing that pop punk thing. It was almost a comedy element to it. And then you had the Go-Go's. The precursor for the Go-Go's and X was a band called The Eyes, which had, you know, DJ Bonebreak, the future drummer of X, and Charlie Caffey, the guitar player in the Go-Go's. So you started to see these bands intermingling around that time. In 78, a harder edge scene starts to emerge from the LA suburbs. This is kind of, you know, punk is more of a Hollywood thing, and now you're seeing these Orange County LA suburban bands coming up, you know, starting to play this hardcore music, which is much more male driven, much more testosterone driven, harder edged in some ways, less diverse.
Violent.
You know,
more violent.
There was a lot of violence in those shows. Black Flag, Fear, The Circle Jerks. Political to an extent. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of The Circle Jerks, very political.
What they did, God's the present, got us in this situation. But they come in, nowhere to run. Everybody's building bombs. No more housewife days on bar lights, television, Disneyland, festival, this is fine!
Very confrontational and a very different sound. But you had these two scenes side by side sort of developing, the Hollywood scene versus the hardcore suburban scene. So by the time X is in full fury with their debut album coming out in 1980, the scene was very vibrant. There was a very active LA punk scene. So how does X get started in them? How do they create their distinctiveness in the midst of all these great bands?
Well, I think from the beginning, X stood out. Although on Los Angeles in 1980 and Wild Gift 1981, you don't hear the vibrant mix of influences as much as you do on the album that we're going to dissect, Under the Big Black Sun. But, you know, 1980's debut, Los Angeles, is a statement. You know, this is us.
Right.
This is West Coast. This is punk. John Doe had met Billy Zoom. The band comes together in 77 with those two. John brings his then-girlfriend, L.A. Underground slam poet, wasn't called that then, Exene Cervenka, to the rehearsals. She winds up in the band. DJ Bonebreak's the last one to join. As you said, he'd been in this band, The Eyes. He occasionally filled in for the Germs on drums. Really underrated as a key thing that solidified that band. Mm-hmm. I mean, his approach to punk drumming was incredibly subtle and very different than 1, 2, 3, 4, right?
Right.
But from the beginning, you know, especially with Billy Zoom on guitar, the range of influences, Bo Diddley, Eddie Cochran, Johnny Cash, a lot of American country, mm-hmm. but hyped up to this punk fury. We can hear bits and pieces of that in Los Angeles, Wild Gift, the first two albums. But I really think Under the Big Black Sun is where they explode the boundaries, which are becoming increasingly narrow, as mm-hmm. you said, with those bands from just outside of LA and the hyperviolence and the hyperactive mm-hmm. tempos. You know, X slows down a little bit, mm-hmm. doesn't lose the fury, but begins to amplify this great tradition of American music. And I think, you know, John was always the scholar. Mm. Billy Zoom knew which guitar licks to rip off, and he was encyclopedic with his love of rockabilly. But I think John Doe knew the traditions all the way back to folk music.
Well, I think the songwriting in particular, you know, Billy Zoom was a great artist in terms of the guitar. You mentioned, you know, the rockabilly, but there was also a lot of jazz influence
in
Billy
yeah.
Zoom's guitar playing. He was like almost a pre-rock and roll in terms of the kinds of influences he was bringing. So mm-hmm. that was distinctive too. But you're right, John had that perspective on what, you know, again, roots music in America, country especially, and bringing that element into the sound. And with Exene, he had a perfect foil. The counterpoint vocals were truly distinctive, the male-female dialogue that they had on stage every night.
Well, and what they represented as a loving couple, mm-hmm. bohemian, both artists following their path, but doing it together.
Yeah, for sure. Now let's go back to our conversation with John Doe. We want to talk a little bit about Under the Big Black Sun too, John. 40th anniversary, I don't know if you were aware of that or keep track of such things, but us
yes.
rock critic geeks do. I still remember the day I bought it, all the X records. Jim and I are huge fans of the band, and those first, I'd say the first four albums are just masterpieces. It's hard to choose just one, but this happens to be the 40th anniversary of Under the Big Black Sun. From what I understand, I think I talked to you before about this, but you had said that basically the first two records were pretty much written, like you had recorded a lot of that material with Ray Manzarek, and it was just a matter of like, this is going on the Los Angeles album, this is going to go on the next record, Wild Gift. And then Under the Big Black Sun was kind of like a reset. What was your recollection of the songwriting process for that record?
Well, we didn't tour like people tour nowadays. We didn't tour for 8 months out of the year. We would tour for maybe three. You know, we'd go out for a month and then come home and then figure out what other, you know, area of the U.S. And maybe we did something in Europe for those first two records. I would say about half of Wild Gift was written as we were recording Los Angeles. I give Ray Manzarek all the credit for choosing the songs that went on to Los Angeles. We had songs like We're Desperate, Adult Books. There were several songs that wouldn't have fit on the sort of dark underbelly, whatever, you know, people said about it, that was on Los Angeles. So I give Ray all the credit for that. Yeah, as we had gotten more and more popular and basically shamed some major record company, which turned out to be Elektra, into signing us, we realized we had to get to business. So, you know, for better or for worse, at the same time, Exene's sister had been killed in a car wreck. And that was something that was in 1980, right as Los Angeles was released. Exene and I had just gotten married before that, so there were a lot of unacknowledged, undealt with trauma that we went through, and especially Exene. I mean, I was close with her sister, but she wasn't my sister. So Riding with Mary and Come Back to Me and Under the Big Black Sun, the song, they were all relevant. I guess we, you know, and plus we were feeling ourselves. We have this band that is a collection of four people that make something, you know, more than just one plus one is two.
Struck me at the time, I'd loved Wild Gift in Los Angeles, and then Chris Gow reviews Under the Big Black Sun in the Village Voice, and these Los Angeles bohemians, you know, have finally, you know, they're connecting with roots and blah 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 blah, and I'm like, I don't know, X was pretty great. The first time I heard Under the Big Black Sun, I was like, wow, you know, daring to slow down, you know, Come Back to Me, and beautiful cover of Dancing with Tears in My Eyes, but also just something like, you know, The Hungry Wolf was such an opener.
I am a hungry wolf, and running with me with my mate.
You know, I roam endlessly with my mate. And it's like, okay, we all knew John and Exene got married, and wow, what's that house like? You know what I mean? They're both wolves.
Well, that makes me laugh because our house was great. It was chaotic at times, you know, because it was a real party pit, you know. It wasn't as though we calculated that. It just was. And I was so fulfilled in that I went to Los Angeles to find some sort of bohemian lifestyle, and damn if I didn't find it. And now we're signed to a major record company. You know, still there's all kinds of, you know, self-deprecating and feeling not worthy and imposter syndrome, which that wasn't even a thing then, but you still had it. But like I say, we were feeling ourselves. We felt like we were so outside of the mainstream that even if we did like Dancing with Tears in My Eyes or Come Back to Me, it was still punk rock because, you know, Blondie had opened that path. They would do things that were like surf rock. We can play a song like Benny King. You know, we did Adult Books, which was sort of similar.
All alive, all alive, they're all in line like Adult Books. I don't understand.
Nick Lowe had said, okay, well, that's all right. You can do that and still be dissatisfied and saying the man.
Where did Dancing with Tears in My Eyes come? Obviously, it's a very famous song, but not the first thing you would think of a punk band from Los Angeles doing during that era. How did you hit upon that song and that particular treatment of that song?
Well, as a kid, I'm of a certain age where we were given folk music as, you know, our little 10-inch records, you know? I don't know if you recall. You probably recall those. I mean, first it was Burl Ives, and then there's Lead Belly, and then there's Woody Guthrie, and then there's Cisco Houston, and there's, you know, and all of it had these stories, you know, getting back to this Fables in a Foreign Land. And Lead Belly is the version of Dancing with Tears in My Eyes that we took our version from, that I learned the chord, you know, figured out the chords from that.
You know, and it also strikes me as that Billy Zoom was always talked about as like this rockabilly guy. And then, you know, some of his guitar textures on this record, that song in particular, you know, you hear the sort of the jazzy influence. And then he's playing saxophone on Come Back to Me, right? You go, man, this guy's even cooler than I thought. It was just kind of like he's doing all this other non-punk rock stuff in the context of a so-called punk record, which I thought was fascinating. And talk a little bit about Billy. I know he was hardcore about what you guys should sound like and what you should be. He wasn't like Johnny Ramone, who basically said, we're doing this and this way only for, you know, 25 straight records. It seemed like Zoom could sort of go outside.
I got to confess, I saw X for the first time with Under the Big Black Sun. It was either the Peppermint Lounge or the old Ritz in New York. And the crowd had pushed me right in front of Billy. Scared me, John. Oh, my God. Those eyes that looked 10,000 yards.
But he always had that big smile on his face.
Yeah, but I was scared. I was I was 16 or something, so.
He's the Chris Walken of punk rock.
Yes.
Very handsome, very blonde, but something very dark going on inside.
Yeah.
Well, Billy's father was a musician in the Midwest and was a jazzer. And they, you know, his mom and dad had like matching Indian motorcycles, and you know, they had paved the way for Billy to be a jazzer. And for his first instrument was woodwinds. So Billy is a musician from beginning to end, and he can build his own amp, so he's got this focus. He's amazing. He consistently, you know, you'll expect him to do one thing and he'll do another. And I'd say his influences were, you know, Merle Travis and Les Paul. You know, so there's a lot of that in his background. But when he heard Eddie Cochran and when he heard Scotty Moore and people like that, it was like, oh, there's my thing.
You can hear the Scotty Moore, yeah.
And I would give Billy credit for bringing rockabilly guitar playing into punk rock. The doo-wop playing that he did on Come Back to Me, in addition to saxophone, but how, you know, what he did on guitar there, and the sort of Les Paul, Scotty Moore stuff he does on Dancing with Tears in My Eyes. And I would even say that that's a tribute to Exene's sister, because you have to continue on in your world and you have to make the best of a horrible situation.
Ask about the have-nots. It seems to me in a lot of ways that the album all builds to that track, and it is this classic kind of, you know, it's a cliche to even say it, but it's this Charles Bukowski guy at the end of the bar. But it seems so prescient, you know, living with this album again for the last week, because we're going to talk to you about its 40th anniversary. This is the game that moves as you play. And it just seems like those people, those working class stiffs at the shot and the beer joint, it kind of went south in a lot of ways. I mean, they have so much anger, rightly so, right? This is the game that moves as you play, right? You can never get ahead. It's rigged. The system's rigged. But talking about this in 82, and it seems like it is shaping everything that's happening in 2022. I was particularly curious about that song coming together.
I don't think at that point there was that sort of anger. I think it was more resigned, and it's like, okay, you know, this is where I am. I get up and go to work. It may not be fulfilling, but I got my, you know, guys at the bar, and that'll do. If you worked it out right, then you could still have a loving relationship at home. It didn't mean that it was all horrible. It was just a working class life. Exene wrote pretty much all the words to that. And it was an ode to her dad, who was a carpenter and in Chicago. That's funny, that line, this is the game that moves as you play. Exene stole that from a board game. I'm pretty sure it was called Astron, and there was a board, but there was a plastic sheet over the board, and there were knobs that you turned, so it was sort of like an Etch-a-Sketch where you didn't move your piece around the board moved, and your piece stayed in the same place, but the board moved. The byline said, Astron, this is the game that moves as you play.
Moves as you play, yeah.
Whoa.
And only a few years later, Husker Du would take another popular kids game and punk rock. You see something good, steal it. You put your own stamp on it.
But I think, you know, it was also at that point there were a lot of, you know, what we used to call old man bars. And that's inviting in a weird way, because you can just sort of check out for a certain period of time. And we were sort of fascinated with that, you know, being young, but seeing how hard work was part of our ethos.
Well, that shout out to the list of, you know, the Heidi Ho and the Get Down Lounge, and you know, and then later you guys would do that with some of the other bands that you considered fellow travelers. There was always this kind of magnanimity to X, you know, good luck to all bands, right? You know,
well, yeah, I think that was part of that's what happened at CBGB's. That's what happened in LA, because you couldn't do it yourself. It just wasn't the support system. Everybody had to kind of work together. You know, it was a little bit like, let's put on a show, kids.
You'd mentioned that, you know, you and Exene were a couple, you were married, and I think you finally got a chance to write about what it meant to be married on this record. It was more personal from that standpoint. There's several songs here that address the idea of an adult relationship, which is, what a revelation, you know? A lot of rock songs up at that point have been about teen romance. This was about two adults trying to make a life together. I always was struck by Because I Do. I'm the married kind, the kind that said I do, forever searching for someone new. What kind of fool am I? I am the married kind that said I do, forever searching for someone new. And I'm going, wow, that's a hell of a line to be singing at each other. You know, I saw you guys perform that song on stage, and it's just like, wow. You know, you're kind of putting it out there, you know, they're married, they're singing about this, like, maybe this isn't exactly working out the way I figured it was going to. And, you know, you don't want to say it's autobiographical, but it could be.
It sort of was. But at the same time, I didn't think, like, I'm in trouble. Just like it was art, just forever searching for the next thing. And Exene is very talented in creating a character and it not just being her, not being autobiographical. Yeah, it may be rooted in something that she felt, but it's not rooted in who she truly is. White Girl was sort of a song about temptation. And yeah, I'm putting the same thing out there. And Exene's just singing along and mm-hmm. You guys are messed up. But we survived. And we survived even when we split up, and that's a beautiful thing. And I honor that relationship and know that as long as we're both alive, we'll be together, at least in that way.
Coming up, we'll finish our conversation with the great John Doe and discuss X's influence on music today. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited. Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. This week, we're talking with John Doe of X. Let's jump back into our chat.
Well, you mentioned earlier, John, Billy sometimes being recalcitrant or putting his foot down. He was the editor of the group. This is good, that's not.
And Xine has had an evolution in her thinking. Four distinct individuals. How do you navigate that? Because, you know, Greg's interviewed you a number of times. I've seen interviews with you. I've read your writings. I mean, you seem to be the easygoing guy in X. I don't know about DJ. He's kind of quiet, right?
But Jesus, that the drums on Hungry Wolf.
How do you navigate that? Four distinct personalities coming back together again over those decades.
Oh, you know, I'd come to say that it's like a family.
You got to get together for Thanksgiving no matter what, right?
You let that sink in, and families are crazy complicated. And you realize, you know what? What's good outweighs what's bad. And living in Texas now, living in Austin, you see a Trump flag, and you have to say, okay, I don't agree with that, but you're part of the world too. And I think that's important. I think living in a place that only has your point of view is tough. It's dangerous, and we respect each other. That's how we navigate it, and we don't sweat the small stuff and whatever has what's ever in the past is. You try to downplay the bad and remember the good. And
we're at such a viciously opposed time in American history. You know, as a beat reporter, I learned early on, sometimes the scariest, you know, the guys in the biker bar who you didn't know if you were going to make it out alive. You know, you got a flat tire. They'll come out and they'll like lift your car up physically and have to change the tire, right? Those guys in the bars, in the have-nots, you might not want to know what they really think about women or about race. But, you know, if a tornado's coming, and are they going to help their neighbors rebuild if disaster comes, right? You know, can't we reconnect with that basic we're all in this together feeling in America?
Yes, I would hope so. And the good people, you know, the Jimmy Stewarts of those working class types will say, well, what the hell, you know? I was actually talking to Shirley Manson about this, and I don't mean to name drop, but I'm giving her credit for it, that it's fear. It's fear of chaos. And that's why people are so angry. I would think, after going through the last 2 years, that there'd be a lot more empathy. But people are afraid. And I think those guys in the difference between now and then, you know, 82 and 22, is the fear. And, you know, the 24 news cycle and all this sort of stuff. Because those guys at the end of the bar, they probably would drop the N-word, but they probably worked with a lot of black folks on their assembly line. And they were happy to have them as their union brother, you know, kind of thing. So,
you know, and that brings us back to fables. You know, if you're talking about trying to stay alive in Deadwood, you may not like the Native Americans, but when things get bad, everybody's in this together, right? You know, taming the frontier required all hands on deck.
It's not a simpler time, but it's more elemental. It is like you either get your food or you starve. You either fix your roof or you freeze. And that's part of what appealed to me. And, you know, on the race subject, the guilty bystander was inspired by the murder of George Floyd. It was right around that same time. And I kept thinking, like, well, what's a song that I could be singing when I was doing some virtual shows? And I thought about the, you know, there's a man going around taking names that Leadbelly did, and, you know, that's about slavery and stuff. And I thought, no, that's not. And then I, you know, happened upon this idea of a guilty bystander. And it means nowadays you gotta get in there. You gotta say the right thing. You gotta do the right thing. And you can't be a bystander. You have to stand up. It's a hard song to sing live because you're saying slaves and masters, and people are going like, oh God, that's prickly. Oh golly, golly, John. Why do you want to bring up such difficult subjects?
It's not like you weren't bringing up difficult subjects before.
And that was true about Alphabet Land. People said, oh God, this is so current and stuff. And it's like, we've been singing about this since the beginning, like the world's a mess, it's in my kiss. And it's just, you know, sometimes things catch up to you and things are, and they're more prescient, as you said.
We are privileged to talk about this record 40 years on because it's so rare to have a record somebody made 40 years ago and go, you know, this still sounds pretty good. This still sounds very
ahead
contemporary.
Of its time. Yeah.
It has aged well, I should say. How do you feel about that record in particular?
I think it's one of the best sounding records we did. And I give Ray Manzarek credit for that as well, because all the Doors records sound like their version of a blues record. They didn't use tricks like Jimi Hendrix did. They didn't use tricks like, you know, some of the other psychedelic bands did. And Ray applied those lessons to us. He just wanted a good performance, and he wanted it to sound authentic and honest and just do it. Serve the song. Don't serve the latest, you know, recording trick or, you know, Billy wouldn't and doesn't use guitar pedals. That's a, you know, blessing.
I guess a real test, too, is like, do you feel good about playing these songs now?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people say, I can't play that song anymore because, you know, I did it 40 years ago. It doesn't represent at all what I am.
We've had to adjust a few things, like in Los Angeles. We don't use the N-word anymore, and that's good because we shouldn't. It was written to hold a mirror up to people. But I am very proud that we can play Hungry Wolf and Come Back to Me. Now we have a fifth member who joins us, and he plays drums while DJ plays vibes. And Billy plays sax on stage, and that's awesome. That shows this other kind of range that we have. We had a really good studio too. You know, we had Elektra Warner Brothers money instead of just Slash Records money.
A fantastic pleasure talking to the great John Doe, author, actor, solo artist, member of X, all around legend.
You know, and I try to be a decent human being. I'm glad I can, and I'm, you know, always grateful for the opportunity to do something else, and I think it's part of being a creative person is someone says, hey, do you want to try to do this thing? You might fall on your face, and it's like, sure, I guess, I'll try.
Why not?
You know, and if you're lucky, you keep your head up, and you learn something, and then you can pass it on to somebody else, or you can include somebody else. And yeah, that's my thing. It's been a pleasure talking to some professionals.
Oh, well, thank you, John.
Thanks,
all right,
John.
Fellas.
Appreciate the time.
Great to see you.
Man, what a joy. It's a good day at work, Greg, when we get to talk to John Doe. We could have gone for hours.
For sure.
You know, I want to add some thoughts about the influence of X 40 years on, especially Under the Big Black Sun, because to me, that's their masterpiece. Mm-hmm. The other records all have great moments. The two before, there were three after in the original incarnation. They've done two more since 1993. But Big Black Sun holds up. I think, obviously, it was a big influence to all of the L.A., Southern California punk bands. We talked about them earlier. But I want to make the case that it also paved the way for the bands that would begin to bring American roots music into punk rock and then that transition to indie rock, right? Mm-hmm. You know, X was never a new wave band, but we saw so many indie rock bands in the 80s that were bringing in elements of Americana. You had mentioned Rank and File came out of that scene, right? Mm-hmm. But I would also say Jason and the Nashville Scorchers,
yeah.
Tex and the Horseheads, Social Distortion, right? Mm-hmm. The Gun Club, usually underrated band. She's like heroin to me.
Los Lobos, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
You know, X and Los Lobos were coming from the same place, part of different communities, but celebrating, you know, the working class, roots sounds, mm-hmm. Ethnic sounds.
We're the family.
I think a big, big influence, we can even draw a line from X to the Replacements or somebody like the Del Fuegos from mm-hmm. Boston. I also want to point out how influential, again, it was to see John and Exene leading the band and intertwining those vocals. We could say, you know, greatest couple in rock, both driving forces of a band up to and including White Stripes or Rilo Kiley, you know, Yola Tango, completely different sounds, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of a couple who lives music and loves one another is inspirational. Now, John and Exene are long since separated, and their differences have been amplified, but that's the case of everybody at X. Four strong individuals who have very different opinions, as John was saying, but manage to function as a unit.
Yeah, and you even think about a combo like, you know, Nick Cave and PJ Harvey on yeah. a track like Henry Lee. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's straight line back to X. Or, you know, we had Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanegan in our
yeah.
studio.
Yeah.
That combo of voices.
Just waking up, some dogs start barking, a bell starts ringing, and you're still missing.
You know, there's a sound that harkens back to Johnny and June and George Jones and Tammy Wynette, but it's cool for rock and roll, too.
Well, that wraps up our classic album dissection of Under the Big Black Sun. And as always, we want to hear from you. Were you an X fan back in the day? 4 decades later, how do you feel about Under the Big Black Sun? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Go there if you want to give us a piece of your mind. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, an in-depth interview with Yola, who released a fantastic record last year and plays Sister Rosetta Tharpe in the new Elvis movie Out Now. I can't think of anyone better for that role right now.
They should have just made a whole movie about Rosetta with Yola.
Absolutely.
All I've done is go, this is who I actually am. If they go, we don't like who you are, I'm like, I can't help you with that. I exist. It was easy to see, yeah, stand for myself. It was easy to give in, yeah, stand for myself.
And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed, where Jim is highlighting a track from a popular streaming show that people can't stop listening to.
Yeah, that's right. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor@soundopinions.org. That's sponsor@soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.